good morning.
Morning, Rabbi.
Hey, Jim, how's it going?
I'm well. How are you today, sir?
Good. Thank you, sir. How's your weekend going?
Pretty good. I guess it is the weekend. I kind of lost track.
Really? That's something I rarely lose track of, which day it is. So maybe that's a good thing.
I don't go. Yeah, I don't have a regular schedule except, you know, for school with the girls. So days almost don't mean anything to me in some respect.
Uh-huh.
The days my wife is home and there are the days that she's not home.
Any questions from last week? We didn't have definitive. I think at one point about rules, when we apply, when we don't. A solid definition. There seemed to be that certain rules were not 100% of the time. Although I started out by discussing that, a definition of rule has to be. But I guess that means in terms of like laws of nature, things of that nature, or personality. So there, you need to have something which works absolutely if you're going to say it's a rule. But like rules of how people abide by certain things. So, like for example, you know, the righteous having a good life. So that's our, I guess, statement. So like maybe it's because of a human statement, it's subject to error. We don't have all the facts. So in general, we say, you know, good person, person's intelligent, here's a good life, although sometimes a person can be intelligent and certain things will not go his way. But when we're talking about how the world operates, you know, the laws that God created, so those are absolute. Like if we say the way anger works or happiness works, so there's a certain exact design how that operates in everybody. There are laws governing that. There's no deviation to God's laws. But in terms of human observation and rules that we, you know, our fabrications, so that will be subject to error. It could be that's where the distinction is going to lie, when sometimes we see a rule that is not 100%, and as opposed to rules that are. I just don't recall offhand the examples we had from last week. Do you recall?
We talked. I'm scanning through my head here. I don't recall which examples we talked about. I know that Doug had a question about, you know, whether or not sometimes might overcome wisdom. And we spent some time on that, but I don't recall specific examples. I apologize.
Mm-hmm. Doug logs on the last one.
I'm here.
Oh.
Good morning.
Good morning, Doug. How you doing? You just
okay, how are you?
Good, thank you. I was just talking to Jim, just rehashing what the... we had a little cloudiness last week on the topic of rules. When we say a rule is absolute or when it's not. So do you recall the specific case that we were... the examples that we had the issue with?
Well, to Jim's point, I'm remembering that, you know, we did raise the question about when it says wisdom is better than weapons, that, you know, sometimes somebody with might who's not very wise may still prevail. And I'm not remembering another case beyond that.
Well, the truth is the second part of that verse, which is 9:17, says that. And that's what we're going to take up that today. 9:18 and 10:1. They're related verses, so we're going to do both of those today. but we did touch on that last week. We said that, and I was just to rehash what I just mentioned to Jim, maybe a possible opening is that when rules are absolutes, those are rules, I mean, laws that God created that govern the universe and everything from human nature to natural laws, things of that nature. So those don't vary. Those are constant. So if we say, for example, that water has a property of irrigation, that's something which is, it's a rule, 100% of the time it irrigates. There could be extenuating circumstances where, there's a rock that's sitting on top of some plant life, and even though water got underneath there, but nothing could really grow because of the pressure of the rock. It doesn't remove the quality of the water that it can irrigate. As opposed to, let's say, a case here where we say that better is wisdom. It says in 9:18, better is wisdom than weapons of war. So the second part of the verse says, but one sinner, one of the commentaries put it, a rogue. Let's say you have an army and you have one rogue warrior who goes off and it defects. So v'chote echad, one sinner, he can destroy much good. Even with the best laid out plans, and even with wisdom, despite the first part of the verse, that wisdom has the capacity to conquer even weapons of war. There are other variables.
Rabbi?
Yes.
And in reading this today, I'm also noticing in 16 and 18, it says wisdom is better than might, wisdom is better than weapons. It doesn't say that weapons aren't good or that might is not good. It just seems to be making the comparison, if you had to choose between the two, wisdom is better, and I don't think we'd argue that it isn't, but it doesn't say that wisdom will always prevail over might, or wisdom will always prevail over weapons. I mean, you could make an argument that an M16 is better than a penknife, but there could be a situation where a penknife will prevail.
Yes.
But still, an M16 would be a better choice.
Right. And that's what we were trying to get to the root of the problem, in terms of when is a rule steadfast 100% of the time and when is it not. It may be a difficult thing to really pinpoint, but we'll see. Maybe with more information we might be able to refine that more. That was really, I think, what we were grappling with.
Doesn't seem to be a rule so much as, to me, as a commentary on the preference of one thing over another in most cases.
As well, I think the deeper concept is that he's saying that the operation of the world, which we talked a number of times about, is it operates by certain principles. And if you don't follow those principles, it doesn't matter that you have a great big sword. And that, because what is the verse a response to? It's a response to the incorrect thought that something steely, something metal and sharp, that is something which is tangible and has great effects on the physical world, whereas wisdom is an abstract thing. You can't even see, you can't even point at wisdom. It's an intangible. So that he's really speaking to this notion that people work with, that the tangible is something which is superior. So he's really getting to the root and saying, no, that's not true. What's true is that even if you have the greatest sword, but if you just use might and you don't try to attack, you haven't determined yet if these people are your enemy or your friend, your ally, so then the sword is meaningless. It can actually be devastating to you if you get rid of an ally. Now you've got less people to team up with you when the real enemy attacks. So without having wisdom and understanding how the world operates, I mean, there is a physical world, but the laws that operate and govern are superior, because that determines when there's going to be a good outcome or not. Because in all cases, we're looking for to succeed. We're not looking to fail in anything. So the real concept here is that work, you know, live your life based on understanding the underlying principles. And if you work with that, then you will succeed. And that's wisdom. And that's an intangible. But don't think an intangible is something which is inferior to, you know, the sharpest sword in the world. Don't evaluate things based on just what you see. And again, that was the theme we saw throughout, that people are assessing value based on what they see here under the sun on Earth. So any people are very attached to the tangible, and that's a constant pit that the people fall into. It's just that we're rooted that way from youth, and we're so geared towards that, and we're so sensual that it's very difficult for many people to rise above that. So I think that's the core principle that he's trying to bring out with that first statement. Now, despite that, he says the second part of the verse. And he means to say that just even though wisdom is superior, but that's only if it's followed. You can have one fool, you can have one rogue that can destroy the best plans. And he can destroy much good. You could have a fantastic plan where nobody would get hurt in this war, and you would succeed, and you'd be able to acquire great wealth and new territory. But one person who, let's say, is an informant to the other side, he can destroy the whole thing. So he's telling you how quantity is not, you know, quality. He's giving you this lesson is how the assumption is that something of overwhelming value or quality, it's only an assumed thing. There might be something which is, in your estimation, is very small, but really, it can have, you know, catastrophic effects. So that's the last verse. And again, since the chapters are not something which we pay attention to, it makes a lot of we have no problem with the fact that the next verse is tied into this. So 10:1, you'll see. You'll explain to me why do you think it's a continuation of this theme. So let's take a look at it. So he says that dead flies can putrefy the perfumer's oil. And more weighty, more significant than wisdom or honor is a little bit of foolishness. Okay, again, dead flies putrefy the perfumer's oil, and more weighty, more significant than even wisdom or honor is a little foolishness. Now again, these concepts are in the same verse, as Rabbi Chet explained. There's a tradition that we have that whenever you have one verse, all the concepts in the verse have to be related. And I think intuitively we see there's a relationship between the first and the second part. But let's see if we can really unravel what's going on here and what the relationship is between the first part and the second part. So I guess the first thing to do would be to understand what is this first illustration? What is the ideas that we can extract from this first illustration that the dead flies putrefy the perfumer's oil?
Rabbi, quick preparatory question. You said that Rabbi Chaik mentioned that all the ideas in the verse need to hold together. You also mentioned the chapter breakdowns weren't made by, I think, the Jewish people, but I think that was maybe a Christian thing later.
Right.
Are the verse breakdowns Torah related?
Yes, those are from God.
Okay.
That's what it's a great tool if we don't know where a verse begins or ends, so then we don't understand. So that's what's called pasuk. Pasuk means to cease or to end or cut off. So here's one idea that you can cut off and isolate. It's isolated. And that's necessary in terms of knowing what are there all of the elements that contribute to a single concept. So you have to know where the verse begins and ends. So that's straight from God. I mean, there are what you can call chapter breaks in the Torah, but they aren't the chapters we have here. Like you said, they were made later on by the Gentiles, that they just needed a way to debate with the Jews, so they made a system of chapters. Since where they had like a numeric way of referring to things when they debated. I believe that's how that evolved. But there are separate areas. I mean, there are single breaks, which are words. There are larger breaks, which are the sentences. And then there are greater breaks, which are what they call a parsha, like a contained area. And that's broken off in the Torah by a gap of letters. So you have maybe a line, holds 25 Hebrew characters, but you'll have a break where you'll have the characters will go across, you know, a few letters, and then it's nothing until the end of the line. Or you may have a gap of 9 letters where there's enough space for 9 letters, but there's nothing written, and then the words pick up again. So there's two types of breaks in the Torah. Okay. All right, so let's understand this first illustration. Dead flies putrefy the perfumer's oil. What's this point? And what are the elements here? And you don't have to just stop there. If you want to read to the end and see if you can get more information because of the second part, since it's related, you can do that too. And I think that's helpful, actually.
Well, Rashi seems to give an explanation of the flies and the foam and the oil of a perfumer. Basically, that when one falls into the oil, then it makes the perfume putrid and foamy. And his point seems to be that an insignificant thing, being the fly, spoils a significant thing, or an important thing, the perfume.
Right. Okay, so that's good. So fly is a small thing. And you see at the end of the verse, it says that more weighty than wisdom and honor is a little foolishness. So it's consistent. The thing which is damaging in both cases is an insignificant thing. It's a small quantity. All right? So that's one parallel we see so far. The other parallel, of course, is that in both cases, the insignificant thing destroys the greater. Question is why? And I mean, is it only oil? And what's the idea about a little foolishness is going to ruin wisdom and honor? And just like there's a parallel between the thing which is destroyed, is there a parallel between the thing which is which was good, but then becomes destroyed?
Well, as an example, I'm thinking of, let's say, a giant banquet to honor a great person, and a legitimately honorable great person, and a huge amount of work goes into it, invitations and all this stuff, and then you get there, and partway into the speeches, some drunk guy stands up and makes a really crazy and foolish comment.
Okay.
It kind of wrecks the whole thing.
Yeah, it ruins the tone.
Right. Now, but you raise a really interesting question. Why is that? Because let's say the drunk guy talks for 30 seconds.
Right.
People have spent maybe hundreds of hours putting this event together.
Right, and let's say the event goes for 5 hours. Why should those 30 seconds be so significant?
Right. That's
Let me give you a better example, which just took place in the news. This guy, Senator Wiener. So there's he's a married guy. I don't know if he's got kids, whatever, but he's been in the politics for years. And it's beyond me that he did this, but whatever he did, he shared some pictures that were inappropriate, and also with very young aged women. But the guy had a great career, and now all of a sudden everybody, and they ousted him, and he fought it, but he finally gave in, and he had to resign from being in politics. And everybody came out against him. What about all the years that he spent, or the decades, who knows how long he was in politics? And let's say the guy did a tremendous amount of good. He did this one act of foolishness. Now, why is it that small quantity should have an effect? And is this true in every area? Let's say a bug falls into my soda. Now, let's say it's a giant pitcher of soda. So I can take out some of the soda that's around the bug, and there's no effect whatsoever. What's the difference between that and the perfumer's oil? And the thing is also, keep in mind, it's talking about wisdom and honor. You notice that. So wisdom and honor. So who is the subject in the second part? I know that oil is the subject in the first part. But what's the subject in the second part of the verse?
Would have to be a wise and honorable person.
Right, a person. We're talking about a person. The question about wisdom and honor. Honor, of course, is not something which is it's dependent type of an element, right? It's the honor of. What's that?
And are we talking about folly that just fell in out of the blue, or are we talking about the person exhibited some folly?
Yeah, the latter. We're talking about the person committed some foolishness. Yes.
I was wondering this in the second part, where it says a little folly outweighs wisdom and honor.
I can't hear you.
If people tend to put, if somebody's in a leadership position, we tend to look up to them and we attach certain good traits to them. And when they display something like the example that you gave of the senator, it all of a sudden puts them down onto that sort of regular human quality. They're not up there on that pedestal anymore. And we don't want leaders that are human in a sense.
Okay, I agree. And why does that one event, though, ruin so much good?
Well, it destroyed our image.
Your image, okay. Interesting point.
It shatters the concept of perfection. If you order a big marble slab for your kitchen, and let's say it's going to be 12 feet by 5 feet, and it's perfect, it has no flaws. If down on one little edge there's a crack, then suddenly the value of that slab drops off significantly. Because it's no longer perfect.
Okay, good.
It'll also be the thing that you notice all the time. Because of it being an aberration, it'll be the thing that draws the eye.
Okay, good. Rivka, you had something to say?
Yes, I did. I wondered But I can't help but think in relation to the long term that he served and so on, it's like a chain. If one link breaks, then it severs the whole thing. It changes the whole idea that the chain is no longer a chain, it's two pieces. It just breaks the continuum. I think when somebody is in politics, especially when it's so open to the public, a lot of people have to make a decision that maybe they wouldn't have made had the person been less noticeable, so to speak.
Right.
I still have a question. I don't know why it didn't happen with President Clinton and other things through history where they did things that weren't exactly kosher, so to speak, and still they didn't have this kind of reaction where they ousted him completely. Yeah.
Doug, you have something?
Yeah, I wanted to follow up on Jim's point. There's Jim saying that, you know, we always look at the flaw. And I agree. And I'm wondering why that is.
Right.
You get a new car and it gets a scratch on it, then it's like it's not new anymore to you, and your eyes will probably disproportionately focus on that scratch, and I'm just wondering why that is.
Right. But you wouldn't do that with a car that's, you know, a 1990s model. It would be the new car. But I think you said it before. I think you said it before. Think about it for another moment. Think about the examples in the verse, though. Why these examples?
One's about things, and one's about people.
Okay, true.
And in the first case, we're talking about something that's worth a lot, so set up on kind of a pedestal, seen as a very luxurious, perfected thing. And the same way for the second case with regard to the person. When we talk about wisdom and honor, those are probably two of the greatest qualities we would attribute to a human being.
Good.
Because we wouldn't say a little folly outweighs the ability to do 500 push-ups.
Right. See, I think you said it earlier when you said the word perfect. I mean, there's certain phenomena which by definition are pure. And if it's lacking that, it lacks its entire essence. Let's use wisdom or honor as an example. So a person who is an intelligent, moral, great honor, why does he have the honor? Because what he's done his whole life has been to the approval of everybody. It's on such a high caliber. That's why a person has honor. There's something that surpasses all others. So he gets the honor for whatever it is. He could be a great philanthropist. He can be a top eye surgeon, whatever it is. And then you talk about honor, and then the person, this foible, he does something so base as sharing the foolish pictures of himself on the internet. Lewd, sexual pictures. So now, what do you think about this person? Let's say it was like a person as great as an Einstein. And then he does something like this. So you've had this image of the person. And I think that's what it's talking about. It's talking about specifically the image that we have of the person. Because he says specifically honor. Honor is something attributed because of our, how we perceive this person. We give a certain singular identity, and that's a key factor here, that we as human beings will relate to other people and we typify them. And that's just natural. What type of person? Here's a person that's a great leader, honor. Now, if he does something as low as this, which really is the complete opposite of what we had assessed the person is, it throws a blemish, just like Jim said. And we question all that honor that we gave him up to this point, and that's why it becomes worthless. And that's why they ousted this guy, the senator. Even though it was one event that didn't hurt anybody, but in terms of the image, and that was something which is intolerable. It's now almost like we feel embarrassed that we allowed him to be in here all this time. We were wrong all this time. So when you have to identify the phenomena. Here the phenomena is the psychological relationship, the way people view others. If you just put your mute buttons on, I'm getting some feedback. Thanks. So, in this case, since we're talking about honor, and honor is something which is the opposite end of the spectrum of foolishness. It can't tolerate it at all. When you have something of this nature, because by the nature of a person is honorable and does great things, the fact that he would do one thing which is foolish, now the credibility is completely gone. And that is due in part because, number one, primarily, it undermines how much greatness the person had all along if he can do this. We always thought he was at the one end of the spectrum, perfect, upright, impeccable. And now he does this, that throws a monkey wrench into the whole reputation that the person had. And it's all questionable now. And everything at this point, it falls down. But it also has a lot to do with the way we relate. It has a lot to do. It's because if you really want to just look objectively, so if he did 99 things great in his career and one thing bad, why should that have such a weight? But it does when it comes to this area because of the way people relate to it. So it's not just the phenomena itself. The fact that he did one wrong thing in his career where he did 99 things that were perfect, really that's a great record. But since there is the way humans relate to others of great credibility, and then they end up doing something foolish, that's in this specific phenomena has an effect. And it's just like the oil. And maybe even, see, oil and honor are similar. Why is oil the case over here? Perfume. See, perfume is not something which stands alone, just like honor doesn't stand alone. Honor is not something which exists in a vacuum. It's the honor of somebody. And that's what perfume is also. Perfume is also something which is to decorate a person. It's something which is a reputation. It's a reputable type of an element, right? It's a compliment. So there's a strong parallel between the two elements. And in as much as a person wants to have that pure scent using a perfume, so something which is so pure, just like the honor of a person. So there, it can't tolerate even one dead fly. Even a minuscule thing as one dead fly is going to spoil the entire aroma. So that's the equation, I believe, the answer. All right, let me stop here and just hear your remarks.
Makes sense to me. And there's a question then left on the table to me that Rivka raised. Why did Clinton escape?
Well, there, he's the one that has the most power. So he can manipulate things. Wiener doesn't. He was not there.
I don't think. Pardon me, Rabbi. I'm sorry, didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
Yeah, that was all I was saying.
But, Rabbi?
Yeah.
All the more reason, because he had the power, to that extent, they should have punished him. I mean, of all people, I don't know how to explain.
Yeah, I understand that, but when you're the president, you can manipulate all those people that can come against you much more than a senator can. And if he had a lot of, honor, he had a lot of people that friendly with him, he was able to, you know, work out with his Teflon tactics and brush it under the rug. And I remember him watching him as he apologized on television. You know, was it 14 years ago, something like that. And how very smooth and how, but we really got to refocus and get back on the country and this and that. He was very good, but it's true, I agree. He should be held to a higher standard. But my point is the reason why he was able to escape is because he was in control of more of the variables than this guy who was a senator. That's why.
There was more reason because he was able to manipulate much more. And that's the scary part, how a person has so much power that they can manipulate others to say it's okay. And he actually, he denied the whole thing, that it never happened.
I know, but that's the point. The point is that you're asking is that how did he get away and this guy Wiener didn't? So I'm saying it's because he was in control of more of the variables to slide things, you know, and to skew things more to his favor. That's why.
I remember you were teaching once, we were discussing about rabbi. A great rabbi gets a greater punishment. And I was thinking to myself, why would a great rabbi get greater punishment? Because more is expected of him. He should know better.
Well, not that he gets, that's right.
It's different. It's not like politics, of course, but it's different, but yet it's still a little bit the same.
Well, the real statement that you're quoting is that God holds the righteous more accountable than others because they should have been, but that's a different idea. It's not this idea. It's related. I actually thought about that too as we were discussing this verse, you know, about 10 minutes ago. That there is, I see why you associate it to it.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good, like I say, a good horror, like Reverend Chait would say, you know, somebody in one of his classes would, you know, say something. I remember when I was there once, and somebody, he was talking about how, I think the case was, how, I think there was a system to which God gives reward, and there were certain times set for reward, and then somebody perked up and said there's also certain times that God punishes, like on Tisha B'Av, the ninth of Av, that God uses that repeatedly for punishments. So Rabbi Chait's response to the person was, like, you had a good association. So you're saying the same thing here. I mean, it's a good association because you're saying that in terms of the person that is more pure, so there's more of a stain when he does the same infraction as somebody who sins all the time. So there it doesn't show up as much. So he's held more accountable because but that's for his own good, because since he's trying to live, you know, perfectly, so God will step in to help him stay on that and not let him veer that much. A person who's veering off the path all the time, so then what's a punishment going to do? Is they keep on doing it. But a person who wants to stay to the right path and he veers off because he's human, so there God will step in. That's what King Solomon says. God rebukes those who he loves. I think is the verse. Those who he loves, those who God loves, he rebukes. I mean, well, who are the ones that God loves? The ones that are trying to live the right life. So when they veer a little bit, God will do something to help them remain and not go too far off the path. So here also, so when you have a person who's honorable, and there's one little thing he does, similarly, there's a great mark. Because there's a purity, there's an element of purity here, which is demanded and intolerable by people. Because we're dealing with honor, we're dealing with something which, this is a phenomena of interaction. Right, and that's perfume also. So I think that's a good analogy too, why perfume is used, because that's something which is about the reputation of a person. If you isolate what's the function of perfume, it's in order to take a regular person and improve the presentation of the person, how the person is perceived. So a person is perceived through the senses, that's perfume. A person is also perceived through his deeds, that's honor. Now, tell me this. Why are these two verses related? 9:18 and 10:1. Right, just like within one given verse, the ideas have to be related. So when two verses are juxtaposed, there's a relationship. What's the relationship here?
Well, we have the concept in the second half of 9:18, one sinner destroys much good. And I think one of the commentators gives the example of a giant military operation, lots of people doing stuff, and if one guy doesn't do what he's supposed to, it messes up the whole thing, which seems to be a similar case to what the first and second half of 10:1 are talking about.
Well, I believe all four cases, the fact that, again, if we go through them, from 9:18 in the beginning, so wisdom is better than vessels of war. You could have tons of vessels of war, tanks, artillery, and grenades, bombs, missiles, whatever. But wisdom is going to have more weight than that. And so also, like you just said, one rogue troop, he can destroy the greatest plans. And also one small fly destroys the oil, and one small act of foolishness can ruin all the honor of a certain person. So in terms of what to value, King Solomon is informing us what should be our barometer of value in various cases. So in the first case, he's saying don't let it be your assessment that the tangible has much more greater impact than wisdom. Like to say the pen is mightier than the sword. That's basically the first part of 18. Right. And then also he follows through on the suit, where he talks about the one warrior that can destroy, meaning it's true that something abstract as wisdom can really be much more in control, greater effects than all the weapons of war. But that does not mean that you can't have a case where something tangible is going to affect the greatest abstract plans, meaning the reverse can also be true in cases. So showing you that, yes, there is that ability in wisdom, but not if you have somebody who's going to defect to the other side. So something in the physical can also be blow up in your face, even with the greatest plans. And again, he continues on the theme in terms of the oil. Now, let's see if we can distinguish what the difference, if there's categorical difference between the two verses. If we could take one more step here. So we said that 10:1 is dealing with reputation. There's more of an intangible type of a destruction. So the first one is tangible. Wisdom can prevent, the weapons of war from affecting you tangibly. At the same time, the very tangible act of this person can destroy the plans. So they were talking about in terms of a very tangible type of a scenario. And the second case is talking more of an abstract, more in terms of the reputation of the person. So I'd say we could separate the two that way, why they're in two different verses. There's practical, and then there's in terms of the social, you might want to say. The 10.1 is dealing with the social sphere. People's estimations of each other. Okay? All right, any questions or comments?
Rabbi?
Yeah.
Rabbi?
Yes?
Daryl was listening. Daryl was listening to the class, and he just also told me that I should insert that if you put one apple, a small apple, into a little bit bruised, and it would be rotten, it could spoil the whole bushel. That's another example of where a little bit can ruin a lot.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that's used quite often.
Mm-hmm.
That's usually in terms of the social framework where you got one person in the group can his attitude. With somebody in the classroom, he could start get the kids joking around, and the teacher can't control anymore. So that's a lot of times where it's used. They use that. They talk about a good apple or a bad apple. Okay, so I guess we'll wrap it up here. That's what I wanted to present today. And so next week we'll pick up with chapter 10, verse 2, right? The heart of the wise is in the right, and the heart of the fool is in the left. So you can take a look. And it goes further on with the fool in the next verse, so we'll see if they're related. So take a look. And we'll pick it up from there. But I think we did the verses we had today. I think we could see the relationship and interesting insights into why it is that in certain cases a little is going to ruin. But again, if the question I had, why if a fly falls into a giant pitcher of Coke, you can just take out the fly, because there the pitcher of soda is not something which is a perfect type of an element where there's a problem with it. You can take out a little bit. There's no real perfection in soda. It's not that type of a, it doesn't have that quality. People don't relate to it that way. But something which is a perfumer's oil, very expensive, right? The same thing, even with gold. Pure gold as opposed to mixed gold. So certain things that have a very high estimation in our minds. So when it's compromised at all, so there it's all the good is not remembered. But certainly in the case of honor, because we held the person in such high esteem, and there's a number of factors why we don't remember all the good, even though it was one act in 1,000 that he did was bad. But we assume that this person was of this high caliber, but this high caliber means 100% of the time. This type of a phenomena has to be pure. That's the nature of a phenomena, of a person who's held to this level. And if he's not, doesn't remain to that all the time, forget it. Because that's really how people relate to it. It's due not so much to the quantity of bad that he did in this case, but it's a lot has to do with the way people relate and what they expect, just because of the human beings and how they tend to typify and what they're looking for in terms of their leaders, the people that they look up to. And they're looking for something pristine. And it could be this is really what's behind the whole motivation in other religions to have saints, because that really allows them to create a pristine image of a person. And that's something which people desire to see. The only thing is that reality, everybody makes mistakes. It's a human nature. We said that's why Yom Kippur is on the calendar repeatedly. It's not just a single phenomenon. It repeats on the calendar because so does it reflects the nature of man that repeats his mistakes. But it's all right. The person has the ability to do tshuva, and he can repent. And sometimes, he's overcome. I remember Chait once saying that a person who sins because of a sudden he's overcome by a certain emotion is not held as accountable as a person who's more premeditated. And sometimes the emotion does, so therefore, there's ways that God judges a person. So each person has his own, God will judge him, and God knows how to judge. The person does this sin, and another person does the same sin. There's a different weight that it can carry in two different people. All right. Okay, so we'll wrap it up here, and we'll pick it up next week, same time, all right?
Thanks very much, Rabbi.
Okay, everybody, have a great week.
Rabbi, you. Be well, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye.